We'll call the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order. The hour 2:30 p.m. having arrived, as soon as we have a quorum. I see I'm here with all my friends. We have today informational hearing regarding EPA registration of pesticides. A little history here for folks that are here today. We had Ann Lindsay from the EPA from Washington, D.C. come several weeks ago. I allowed her to have the entire committee time to present her testimony on how EPA registers pesticides. We had requests at that time from some folks that disagreed with some of her past history, if you will, wanted to testify that day, and I would not allow that since Ms. Lindsay was our guest from Washington, D.C. I wanted her to have the entire amount of time, but I did say I would give opposing views equal time, and that's what we're going to do today. So we have on the agenda Samuel Yaman. I want to say that name right. Is that correct? Yaman, thank you. Oh, it's Norwegian. Okay. Samuel Yaman, Dr. Jennifer Sass, and Dr. Tyrone Hayes here to testify today. We're not going to allow today the people that disagree with their points of view to testify. Tomorrow we will be hearing the my bill to appropriate $1.25 million to the second Harvest Food Shelf. That will be the first bill up. And then we have three atrazine bills up, one from Representative Wagenius, one from Representative Ellison, two from Representative Ellison, and one from Representative Wagenius. We will hear those bills and hopefully get much of that done. The way we will run those bills, as we usually do, is we will give equal time to both sides, and then we will hopefully be able to vote on those three. If we do have to carry one over, possibly, we may do that. I will try to get all three of those voted on tomorrow also. Okay, with that being said, we'll start up with Samuel Yaman. Samuel Yaman. And so today, before we start, Mr. Yaman, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the side of the folks we have here today that would like to testify other than the three people we have here today? Is there anyone that would wish to testify against? What? No, I'm just kidding. That wasn't the deal. That wasn't the deal. Deal's a deal. Okay, welcome to the committee, sir, and shortly, hopefully, we'll get some members of the committee here, but you are on record and on tape, so your testimony will be heard by folks at certain times when anybody can get the tape. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Samuel Yaman, a public health scientist, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Minnesota law provides the state's Department of Agriculture with the authority to impose restrictions on pesticides as part of the registration process to prevent, quote, any unreasonable risk to humans or the environment, unquote. However, dozens of pesticides with serious health effects are registered for use in Minnesota without a health risk evaluation by state agencies. In 2003, pesticide sales in Minnesota included nearly 7 million pounds of chemicals characterized by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as probable human carcinogens, 8 million pounds of hormone-disrupting chemicals, and nearly 4 million pounds of reproductive and developmental toxins. With this volume of hazardous pesticide products, it is imperative that toxicologists and human health risk assessors be involved in the pesticide registration process at the state level. The logical state agency to turn to for this expertise is the Department of Health. Currently, required materials for pesticide registration in Minnesota include a one-page application form, payment of fees, a copy of the product label, and a copy of the product material safety data sheet. None of these materials contains enough information to evaluate the long-term risks to human health and wildlife from pesticide products. A material safety data sheet, or MSDS, is not an adequate substitute for a comprehensive health risk assessment. The purpose of an MSDS is to provide information for industrial compliance with OSHA and DOT regulations on handling of chemicals, such as labelings and signage, and chemical properties such as solubility, flammability, etc. MSDSs say little, if anything, about long-term health effects from exposure through drinking water, food, or other pathways. Most of the health information in an MSDS is concerned with short-term effects of exposures likely to occur in industrial settings such as chemical spills and effective first aid measures and personal protective equipment. A few sentences at most will discuss long-term effects of exposure, and that information is often outdated and incomplete since long-term effects are not the primary concern of an MSDS. It is intended as a quick reference during an emergency. At the hearing on February 16th, Ann Lindsay of EPA said, quote, states under the federal pesticide law can be more strict than EPA if they choose to do so. There are states that have very rigorous evaluation programs, so they will look at the same data that we do, make their decisions about which pesticides they allow, and on their market they may impose different requirements above and beyond those which we do. There are other states at the other end of the spectrum that basically require registration in the sense that they want to know that this product is being sold in their state, but they're not actually doing an evaluation of their own, unquote. Minnesota falls at the end of the spectrum with states that do not look at the type of health studies and toxicology data that EPA looks at, the states that do little more than collect fees when registering pesticides. At the same hearing on February 16th, Paul Lehman of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture spoke about pesticide registration and said, quote, we do not do risk assessment, unquote. If our state government professionals in toxicology and human health were included in the pesticide registration process, we could be confident that a thorough risk assessment is performed by qualified public health scientists for chemicals like acetachlor, a hormone disruptor and probable human carcinogen, chlorpyrifos, a potent nervous system toxin, 2,4-D, a chemical that has been linked to a variety of health effects, including birth defects and reproductive problems among men and women in rural Minnesota. Those are just a few examples of pesticides with serious, well-documented health effects that should be evaluated carefully to make sure the benefits outweigh the risk.
Mr. Yaman, excuse me if you could just hold that point there. We have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Moe moves the minutes of the joint meeting of Wednesday, March 9th, 2005. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, thank you very much, sir. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those are just a few examples of pesticides with serious, well-documented health effects that should be evaluated carefully to make sure the benefits outweigh the risk. Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy urges you to consider including health and toxicology experts in the pesticide registration process and having those experts conduct a thorough health risk analysis on pesticides. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions at this point? How would Mr. Curry, how would you like this? I'm kind of going to defer to you since this is your day. Would you like to have all the testimony first and then we can question all three, or do you want to go questions of each person as they go? Or as we go, okay. Any questions at this point for Mr. Yaman? Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Yaman, it was my understanding from doing some research and reading on this that there was a press conference held here not too long ago, and in that press conference it was stated that it's your belief that most farmers are looking to stop using atrazine and these other chemicals. How is that based? Do you believe that? What is that based on?
Mr. Yaman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. If you're asking whether farmers are trying to reduce their use of certain pesticides, I'm just not sure if I'm getting the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I tried to write down when I heard the press conference that it's, I think it was said word for word that it was stated most farmers are looking to stop using atrazine was what I wrote down quick when I heard it. And I guess I'm just wondering, what's that? I mean, is this most farmers? You just talked to five farmers and you said most farmers, or how is that comment, or how is that statement, I guess, based on? What's it based on?
Mr. Yaman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I just wanted to include in the record that that wasn't my statement at the press conference, but in attempting to address what might have been intended by whoever did make that statement, it sounds like a sensible approach, not only with atrazine, but with any pesticide that has been documented to have serious health effects or other impacts on the environment. That sounds like a sensible approach to try and minimize the use of that chemical. Beyond that, since that wasn't my statement, I can't really speculate as to what the individual meant when they said that.
Representative Pinstead. Any other questions for Mr. Yaman? Okay, thank you very much, sir. Okay, next is Dr. Jennifer Sass, a scientist, Natural Resources Defense Council, Washington, D.C., and then we'll go into Dr. Tyrone Hayes, and I am going to kind of manage the time here a bit because Dr. Hayes has a PowerPoint presentation, so I think we're pretty good on time, but we'll just see kind of how it goes. I want to make sure that the folks that have traveled for some distance are able to testify here. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Sass. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then begin your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Jennifer Sass. I'm a PhD scientist in the Health and Environment Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. The NRDC is an environmental nonprofit group. We have several different programs. We have offices in four different cities across America. And again, I'm in the health program there. It's my job in Washington, D.C. to oversee the national regulations, federal regulations of all pesticides and toxics. So I follow how the EPA regulates not just pesticides, but many other toxics as well. And I, of course, oversee all the pesticides. My job is to look at the science and the data underlying the regulations and to comment and evaluate it as EPA evaluates its chemicals for re-registration.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I do thank you for the invitation and for your attendance and attention. This is such an important issue for your state, for yourselves, your families, and your constituents, and I do thank you for the time that you've taken and for your attention during this talk, and also for considering all the perspectives as you make your important decisions about chemical usage and pesticide usage in your state. Today, I'm going to describe the EPA's process for regulating pesticides in brief, and I'm going to specifically comment on the EPA's evaluation of atrazine as an example of a chemical. It illustrates some points that I wish to make, which is bearing on the openness, the claims of openness and transparency in the pesticide registration process at EPA. The EPA, the Federal Regulation of Pesticides, is essentially comes under four congressional mandates or laws, the FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, the FFDC, Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and then the Food Quality Protection Act, FQPA, and also FACA, the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And I just want to give you one or two sentences on each of these as they relate to the pesticide regulations. First of all, FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, prohibits the use or sale of any pesticide unless EPA has approved it for registration. So it obligates the registration and review of pesticides before they enter into commerce. It gives EPA the opportunity to either not register, to re-register, or to limit the use of a pesticide unless the agency determines that its labeling or other material that are required for it to comply with the regulations of this act are submitted appropriately, that it performs its intended functions without unreasonable adverse effects on the environment, and that when used in accordance with widespread and commonly recognized practices, it will not generally cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. And this is under FIFRA taking into account economic, social, and environmental costs and benefits. That's built into FIFRA. Under the FFDC, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, this essentially regulates consumer exposures to pesticides, residues, where consumers may be exposed through food and drinking water or any other source. The Food Quality Protection Act was a 1996 amendment passed unanimously in Congress, and it obligated the EPA to use a health-based and child protective standard. It had that as an interesting amendment or addition to the regulation of pesticides, and one other thing. It obligated the EPA to consider the cumulative effects of a pesticide. And the way those words are used is the aggregate effects are all the different ways that a single person, and in this case under FQPA, specifically a child or vulnerable population, whatever we identify as that, all the different ways that a person may be exposed to that particular pesticide, and then the cumulative effects, in addition to the aggregate, you take all the aggregate, and then you accumulate the effects of pesticides that share a common mechanism group. So, for example, with atrazine, all of the triazines, their chemical cousins, are being evaluated together. The organophosphates are another group that's being evaluated together, and the carbamates as well are being evaluated as a cumulative group. And once the aggregate impacts of a particular chemical have been evaluated, the EPA will publish an IRED, the interim re-registration eligibility decision, and then the IRED's, the EPA's final determination after the IRED will then include the cumulative effects from that common mechanism group, and that will form the RED, no longer an interim, but now a re-registration eligibility decision, or the RED. And atrazine has not gone through a RED at this point. In other words, the triazine as a cumulative group have not been evaluated yet, but atrazine as its particular aggregate exposures has been done, and an interim re-registration eligibility decision, or an IRED, has been issued. And then the Federal Advisory Committee Act. The Federal Advisory Committee Act, or FACA, essentially says that when an advisory committee is convened to advise the federal government, the EPA in this case, that when this committee includes at least one non-federal employee, then the FACA when this committee is also providing advice or recommendations to the agency, then FACA ensures that the advisory committee is formed, quote, in the public interest, end quote, and is, quote, fairly balanced in terms of points of view represented and functions to be performed, end quote. And as well, it obligates these committees to not contain members with inappropriate special interests. Now, sometimes there are members of special interests that are on the committees, but waivers may be issued if these people have particular expertise that is needed to make certain decisions.
That point, Representative Magnus.
Mr. Chairman, and to the witness, what would be an inappropriate special interest?
Dr. Sass?
Can you give me an example of that, Dr. Sass?
Sure. Well, according to an inappropriate special interest, that would be, according to FACA, it would include someone who had a particular financial interest or was employed directly by an employer that had a financial interest in the topic of discussion or deliberations of that committee. And that would be a direct financial interest. And as I said, sometimes waivers are given when people have particular expertise that's important to the committee. And I'll give you an example of that. These are scientific committees, not stakeholder committees. But when a scientist who's employed by a corporation or a company, and the company may have sponsored the epidemiology on the workers, the exposed workers in its workplace, that often happens, then the main author, although they were sponsored and funded by the company, may also have particular expertise or knowledge of that study that's important and something that should be brought to bear in the committee. That's an example.
For some Magnus.
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, Dr. Sass, has your organization, do you participate in any of these advisory committees?
Dr. Sass?
EPA?
No, I have not been on any of the advisory committees on EPA. I have provided public comment as a public commenter I would say at almost all of them, and certainly all of them relating to atrazine and most of them relating to pesticides. As a public commenter, I have not sat on any of them.
Chairman, Dr. Sa, has your organization seek to place anyone on the committee, on these advisory committees?
No.
Dr. Sass, okay.
Seek to place one of us? Is that... Yeah, no. We have provided nominations. There's a public nomination procedure when one of these are convened. There are regular members that are called on for they have a specific number of years that they serve, and then there are special experts for each specific committee. And we have nominated or provided suggestions for different members. Never ourselves.
I've never been successful in getting anyone on there.
Pardon me?
Dr. Sass, you've never been successful in getting anyone you've nominated onto the committee then.
Dr. Sass?
I'm sure there's been times where sometimes people that we've nominated have been appointed to the committee. I don't recall right now any particular scientific advisory panels. The SAP or the advisory panels oversee pesticides. There's also scientific advisory boards. I mean, there's literally over 1,000 of these in the federal government. And I know that we've had nominees to scientific advisory boards that have been selected.
Okay.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sass, you mentioned those chemicals that you mentioned earlier. Are any of those chemicals found in any common household items?
Dr. Sass?
I mentioned the pesticides, I think the cumulative groups, the triazines, the carbamates, and the organophosphates.
Yes.
Many of them were. One of the things that's happened under FQPA, the Food Quality Protection Act, during the re-registration process is that the EPA has weighed the risks and benefits of the different chemicals. For instance, with the organophosphates, I think there's 34 of them. With the carbamates, I think there might be about 7 in the group. The triazines, I think about have 5 or 7 in the group. I'm not sure exactly. And many of them that are the worst, let's say the writing is on the wall, have been phased out or canceled. Often voluntary cancellations or phase outs from the manufacturer when it's evident that the risks in household uses or yard uses where children are most highly exposed may be exceeding safe levels, then those may be canceled. And that's happened with almost all of the organophosphates, for example. So almost all of the indoor uses or household uses of the organophosphates have been voluntarily withdrawn or phased out over a number of years at this point.
Representative Hamilton?
I'll hold on for a minute.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Sass, does your organization believe that any pesticides are in legitimate use, or is your organization against all pesticides, or what's your position on that?
We're not against all pesticides, but we do believe that pesticides should be used responsibly and that they should be evaluated with all the data that's available, and they should undergo a full and informed scientific evaluation. We think that they should be used reasonably and responsibly, and particularly we don't think that they should be released into the environment unnecessarily. So, for example, with atrazine, I know that there are ways of using it where you can both reduce your use patterns and also not release it into the environment. And I met last week with the Illinois Agriculture Leadership Group. This is a group of about 40 or 50 people, and everyone in the room, they're all farmers and farm backgrounds, and everyone in the room told me that they use atrazine at least less than half of the label rate, and they get the full effect of atrazine by using it at least less. Many of them told me they use it at a quarter, and I asked them if this was every year or just some years, or does it depend on the pest pressures, and they said no, every year. As a matter of fact, I'll quote them when they said to me that only the old guys use it at the maximum label rate at this point. They also use buffer zones. I asked them what old is, they will tell you.
And I think it's totally inappropriate the members of this committee are looking at Representative Magnus. It's just wrong.
I asked them what the definition of old was, and they did actually answer me. But before I tell you that, I want to point out that they were all around 25. And they were referring to their parents, and they said the old guys were 50 and over.
It's a cruel world.
I think what they meant was wise, and need to think more carefully about their pesticide usage, like us young and smarter guys. But that's what they said to me. And what they use instead is some mixes, reduced rates, lower volumes, and agriculture or buffer zones. In other words, leaving a crop or plant areas between the field where it's being sprayed and the water, and also not using so much broadcast technique so that it's not spraying so much. And we didn't have a long conversation about it, but I did have about an hour with them, and they felt it was very, that their practices were reasonable and they were getting the full effect.
Okay, any questions for Senator Erdahl, and then we'll let you continue your testimony. Senator Erdahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sass, we've had kind of an ongoing discussion around here about atrazine. We have, I think, several bills we're going to be considering tomorrow on that topic. And our committee in the recent past was advised by the United States EPA and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture of the process used to evaluate pesticides and specifically atrazine. With this ongoing evaluation of atrazine as we see, going on as we speak, are you advocating that the Minnesota legislature make decisions now regarding atrazine before this study has reached its conclusion?
Dr. Sass?
Sir, I can't comment on that. I can tell you that I do think that you're the people to make the decision, and that, I mean, I'm coming to you from Washington. I'm coming to you to talk to you about how the federal government has regulated pesticides and atrazine specifically. But really, all the risks and all the studies that I've seen and that I've read, and that the scientific advisory panels, there's been two in the recent past, one that's looked at the amphibian or endocrine disruptor effects, and Dr. Hayes will talk to you about that, and one that's looked at the cancer effects. And that committee advised EPA not to call it a not likely carcinogen. EPA right now is classified EPA as not likely to be carcinogenic. They did so against the advice of their scientific advisory panel. And I've discussed that. We have a lawsuit bearing on that, and I've cited the actual scientific advisory panel report by website in here. They would like to review all the data. They were supposed to review all the data in an agreement with NRDC, my organization, but instead they were tasked, the scientific advisory panel was tasked with only looking at prostate cancer. One type of cancer, that's it. In fact, they did not give a full and informed review of all the relevant data on cancer. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, which is the only international body that evaluates chemicals for carcinogenicity, evaluated atrazine in 1999 and determined that based on the animal data, which this SAP, this was not charged with looking at, based on the animal data were sufficient to call atrazine a carcinogen, but the human data were inadequate.
Dr. Sass, did you say that a board overruled the wise wisdom of their staff?
I'm not sure what you mean by the board, but the EPA.
Yeah.
has classified atrazine as not likely a carcinogen, and this is in spite of the advice of their scientific advisory panel, which said that that was not a valid classification.
So kind of like the staff was overruled by the board, be kind of like campaign finance board? Kind of.
Well, the scientific advisory panel, their advice was ignored by the EPA.
Just like what we got here in Minnesota, same thing. Okay, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's kind of an inside Minnesota story there, Dr. Sass. But
it's a common story.
Yes.
Tell me about it. Expensive, too. I mean.
You use expressions being full and informed, and coming back, to my question, with a study ongoing, the need perhaps for us to be full and informed before we make our decisions.
Dr. Sass?
You have a wise comment, and being a scientist, I love data, and I never say no to data. That's my position. So I always want to see the data. I want to see as much data as I can. I want to see all the data. But as regulators and as policymakers and as people charged with protecting the environment, protecting commerce, and protecting public health, you need to always make decisions in the face of inadequate data. I think naming toxics that we have all the data we're ever going to have on, lead and asbestos and maybe tobacco. We probably have the most data on those. So there will always be more studies, I hope, and I hope there will always be better studies, but we need to act now. The truth is there's 60 to 80 million pounds of atrazine going out into our environment every year, and you'll be bearing most of the risks of that. You'll be bearing most of the benefits here in the Midwest, but you'll also be bearing most of the risks. And if the risks are 1 in 100,000 or 1 in a million or 1 in 10,000 because there's different types of endpoints that have different types of risks, different types of cancers, different kinds of endocrine effects, you'll bear all of that. I won't. My atrazine levels are not that high. It's in DC water, yes, but it's not as high as what you and your constituents and your families bear. And, that 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000 is going to be all here. Those risks, and that's the way risk is. Risk is not distributed evenly across the population. It will be borne, in the case of atrazine, I believe, by the young, people who are exposed earlier, by people who can't detoxify, people that have liver kidney diseases, the elderly, people who are on cancer or chemotherapy treatments, people who may be exposed to a lot of other endocrine chemicals as
okay.
well.
Dr. Sass, you've got more testimony. I'm going to try and manage time here. I have to go with Representative Welty to his office for a meeting. Did you know we got a meeting at 3? Yeah, okay, we'll go there for a little bit. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Johnson. I still have Representative Erdahl has the floor, and then Representative Pennis has a question. And then if we could get back in your testimony, because I want you to present your testimony and appreciate you letting us ask questions as we go along here. So I'll turn the gavel over to lead Democrat Ruth Johnson.
Go ahead, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure the tape was rolling because that wise comment I thought was very appropriate. Thank you, Dr. Sass.
Question from Representative Pennis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to the testifier, I have a couple of questions. But first of all, you're asking us to make a decision that Washington will not and has not for some time. I get the indication that we've known that atrazine is so terrible for a long time, yet Washington doesn't make the decision, but yet you're saying as a state we should make that decision. I hope you watch out when you walk out of here today and across the street because you'll probably get hit by a car or a truck because I often do. But anyway, so is that the brunt of this? We're supposed to make a decision that Washington is not willing to do. And then I guess the next thing I'd like to comment on, when I look at this, at several of these papers, and I see the age of the copyright dates of them, science has a half-life of less than 5 years, and to make an intelligent decision, as Representative Erdahl was talking about, we need to look at primary research, the primary sources, not the opinions of many that have been deciphered out of all this, and some of it, I think I saw one article back to 1964, we can go back to Rachel Carlson's Silent Spring, of which part of it was true and part of it wasn't. So, I guess, if you want to comment on the data, I don't know, we're going to have to ban caffeine and DEET and triphosphates and some of these things that have been proven endocrine disruptors. I don't know that we have the research, and then I guess we get the knowledge out to the people, and they have a right to make a decision too.
Dr. Seth.
Yeah. First of all, it's Rachel Carson who wrote Silent Spring.
That's what it said, didn't it?
I heard Carlson, but Carson.
I live with Carson.
I always watch when I cross the street. And I don't know what data you're talking about, but atrazine has not been researched for that long. I think the data, most of the data, 90% of the data, I'm sure is less than 10 years old. It just hasn't been researched that long. And I don't know where I've heard of a half-life of data of 5 years. I've never heard of that before. I mean, people still cite Maltoni's documents in 1972 on vinyl chloride, and that is still true. I'm not sure what you mean by a half-life. If you mean that it's dead or wrong or defunct after 5 years, I've never heard of that before. It's simply not true.
Representative Pennis?
Yeah. Let me clarify it. The amount of knowledge that we gain in science has a half-life, so to speak, like something radioactive, of about 5 years. We're moving very, very rapidly on it. Okay? Some things are going to always be true, like gravity. You know, but in research, if we're really objective, a lot of it is thrown out along the way. You know, everything that was written is not true necessarily.
I'm not sure where you're getting.
Well, okay,
that.
Just get that. Answer the second part of the question. Excuse me.
We still say
excuse me. Excuse me. If you would answer the other part of the question, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I'll make it simpler. Why didn't Washington, D.C. then make a ban? Dr. Sass.
Can I answer that question by going through my testimony?
Please proceed.
Well, I can give you a short answer if you'd like.
Dr. Sass.
The reason why the federal EPA did not call for a ban is probably a complex answer that only the EPA could answer. But what I can show you here, and by four lawsuits that my organization has filed against the EPA, is that in reviewing atrazine and the toxicity data of atrazine, they did not in fact do a full and informed review of either the endocrine effects. In fact, they have not evaluated atrazine for its endocrine effects. And they did not do a full and informed review of the cancer effects. They did two broken reviews several years apart, and neither one of them were a comprehensive review. The most recent, the one that they're relying on, only looked at prostate cancer, as I said. And in fact, it only looked at two studies. In addition, they shut out the public for most of the negotiations that happened in the decisions on atrazine, formed two committees with EPA and Syngenta, which is the primary manufacturer of atrazine, had over 50 meetings, none of which were docketed in a timely manner according to the law, some of which were docketed weeks or years later so that the public us didn't know that those meetings were happening, certainly didn't include us in any of those meetings, and did come to decisions about the registration process in those meetings. We have over 20,000 pages of documents now from a Freedom of Information Act that we filed demonstrating these meetings, although many of the contents of those have been blacked out and many more thousands of pages were withheld from us. Now, why EPA didn't regulate atrazine more strictly or a complete ban or even some restrictions to it, I don't know. I'm sure it's complex. But what I do know is that nobody in the public really knows, because a lot of those kinds of discussions happen outside of the public view.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Question coming off of...
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question to build off Representative Pennis. She mentioned about 13 different endocrine disruptors. And those in the U.S. Geological Survey, I think is what you're referring to, the endocrine disruptors, they talk about nicotine, shampoo, bug repellent, and some of those items. Are those products, are they need to be registered?
Dr. Sass.
It's hard for me to comment on the 13. I'm not sure what she means by the 13.
Okay.
Now, the ones that you're talking about go through different types of regulation, and not necessarily the pesticide regulations, and they're not in food products or things like that, which is what atrazine, the kind of regulations that atrazine went through. I can't comment because I don't know what 13 she's talking about.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hamilton.
Okay. Then following up on another question that Representative Pennis had, she talked about the U.S. or the federal government not going out a full ban on atrazine. You made a comment about working with Illinois and working with them, am I correct, about them cutting back on atrazine but not a full ban? Is that correct?
I didn't say I was working with them. I said I met with them last week and had a conversation with them, and they said that they restrict atrazine use in their own practices.
Okay, but it wasn't, Madam Chair?
Representative Hamilton.
But it wasn't a complete ban that was talked about there?
That's correct.
Okay, so then my follow-up statement, Madam Chair, would be if that's what's being talked about in other states, and Minnesota is being looked upon or forced, if you will, to ban atrazine, that'll definitely put our farmers at a competitive disadvantage, just for the record.
Dr. Sass, if there are no further questions or comments, please proceed with your testimony.
I'm going to move to just touch in one sentence on each of the lawsuits that we filed and then go to some comments about Dr. Lindsay's testimony to you. Dr. Lindsay from EPA, Ann Lindsay, testified that there were, quote, mischaracterizations of the regulatory process that call into question the scientific soundness and the integrity of our work. Since public confidence is essential to the effectiveness of any regulatory program, EPA welcomes the opportunity to correct the record. And I was glad that they were able to address you, and I'm equally glad to be able to address you as well and to have your attention. But unfortunately, we have looked through the record, at least the record that we've obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, and while we have been forced to question the integrity of the registration process of atrazine, we also have documents to substantiate our claims. We filed four lawsuits. The Endangered Species Act lawsuit alleges that the EPA failed to consult with U.S. Fish and Wildlife as required by the Endangered Species Act. In fact, Fish and Wildlife wrote EPA a letter, and in their letter, and I quote, due to an inability to fully characterize and assess the ecological risks posed by atrazine, it does not appear that EPA will be able to fulfill its legal responsibilities under Section 7A2 of the Endangered Species Act to ensure that its proposed re-registration action is not unlikely to jeopardize the continued existence of listed species or destroy or adversely modify designated critical habitat. U.S. Fish and Wildlife in that letter pleaded with EPA to consult with them, to have conversations with them on atrazine, but EPA chose not to have those conversations and not to work with Fish and Wildlife. We have another lawsuit charging, alleging that EPA violated our agreement with them by refusing to fully evaluate the links between atrazine and cancer. This was filed in 2003. And as I've said in my notes, not only did they not look at all the cancer, but in fact the scientific advisory panel that looked at the prostate cancers only criticized EPA for ignoring atrazine's links to other cancers and stated that it might be, quote, misleading, unquote, to review only the prostate cancer data. The advisory panel further demanded that EPA review data on atrazine's links to all cancers and chastised the agency for flatly asserting that there is no link between prostate cancer and atrazine. We have a FOIA lawsuit as well. This is because we filed a number of Freedom of Information Act requests, and EPA has discounted or delayed responding to them. We did get over 20,000 pages of documents, and these documents reveal that the White House and the Syngenta, primarily industry, was involved in making critical decisions about how to re-register and regulate atrazine. And I brought with me a copy both of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife letter that I referred to earlier, as well as a copy of a memo by Senator Bob Dole when he was meeting with White House Deputy Chief of Staff as part of the lobbying efforts. And in that memo, he says that atrazine is safe. We have a FACA lawsuit This is because we know that with the documents that we received through FOIA, that the agency met secretly more than 40 times with representatives of Syngenta, atrazine's main manufacturer, while evaluating its toxicity. There are other chemicals that they've done this with as well, and we've cited that in our lawsuit, and I've talked about that with you. Dr. Hayes will talk to you about some of the endocrine disruption data and a little bit about the limited review of that data. But my question to you is, if EPA was really concerned with finding out whether atrazine did have endocrine disrupts, or even less, finding out whether Dr. Hayes's work was valid, why didn't they have it repeated by their own in-house scientists? I don't know the answer to this question, but apparently in Duluth, in your own state, you have five research branches of the division, and these are apparently the top scientists in the country, include some of the top scientists in the country that do this kind of work, and they are ready and able to, within several months, I've been told, repeat and evaluate Dr. Hayes's findings, but for some reason they haven't been consulted. As a matter of fact, one of the experts in that lab was one of the authors on the EPA white paper on amphibians and atrazine, and was not asked to repeat his work. Instead, the Syngenta, the manufacturer, has attempted to repeat it, although their work was evaluated by the scientific advisory panel and deemed as flawed and therefore unable to contribute to the determination of whether atrazine was in fact an endocrine disruptor or not in frogs. I think that the EPA pesticide program put out its annual report. It's called Taking Care of Business, and Ann Lindsay testified to you that the atrazine review has been a model of transparency and openness, but unfortunately NRDC hopes that this is not a model for how EPA is planning on taking care of business in the future.
Dr. Sass, I've got some questions here. How much longer is your prepared statement?
As long as you need.
What we're going to do for time here is we'll go until a little short of 3:30 with your testimony and questions. Then Dr. Hayes has about a half-hour PowerPoint, and then I want to let the members ask Dr. Hayes some questions, too. You're doing a great job, too. I kind of want to split the time up here. Dr. Magnus.
Well, I could wait till the testifier is done.
Okay.
That's fine.
Please continue.
No, I'm finished. Thank you.
Oh, you're done?
Oh, finished.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Dr. Person Magnus.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sass, you mentioned the current use of atrazine is about 60 million pounds a year. Is that in the U.S. or where is that?
That's across the U.S. Those are the EPA numbers in the IRED, between 60 and 80 million pounds a year.
Well, 60 to 80?
Between 60 and 80.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Sass, is that number going up or going down over time? Can you give me a trend on the use of atrazine? If it's 60 to 80, that's quite a range.
It's quite a range.
But how is that going in?
Actually, there's somebody from Syngenta here, and maybe they might be able to answer the trends. Maybe they might be able to answer that question better than I can.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Magnus.
We keep switching chairman on you, Dr. Seth. I was just wondering how many of us old guys are left to use this stuff. But because I guess I am over 50, aren't I? Close to it.
Barely.
That's not on the tape.
Barely.
That's not on the tape. I thought we were talking to an expert here on atrazine, but how about total pesticide use in the United States? Could you give me some numbers? What's going on with that? Is that
in terms of the trends?
Right. Is it declining or increasing, or at what levels are we at?
Well, we're in a process over these last few years right now because of the Food Quality Protection Act and because of the re-registration evaluations. One of the criteria in the consent decree with NRDC under the Food Quality Protection Act was to evaluate the pesticides in a worst first order. And so that's why the organophosphates, the carbamates, and then the triazines. And so the statistics aren't, I don't think, are keeping up with the patterns of what's happening, but a lot of the, like we do know for sure that a lot of the, there's already been health benefits from the reduction of the worst, the organophosphates, in indoor urban uses, as we talked about earlier. So there have been studies recently published in the scientific literature. So already scientists are noting that there's been improved birth outcomes associated with, statistically associated with, the reduction of organophosphates in indoor housing in large cities.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Sass, I asked a specific question. I asked how many pounds of atrazine or how many pounds of total pesticide did we use, for example, 7-8 years ago, and how many pounds are we using today?
My understanding is that statistically what I see on the in the numbers is that it hasn't changed very much. That 60 to 80 is a large range. It depends annually on pest pressures and different things like that, weather and pest pressures. That hasn't changed much. But I'm not sure if that's accurate. I'm not sure if the statistics have kept up with the use patterns. Well, because of the changes over the last few years.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Sass, I had a little time to play on the Internet a while ago, so I was looking up some numbers, and I got these from the USDA. I'm sure you can access those too, but the numbers I showed, quantity of pesticides applied in the major crops in the U.S., which would include corn, soybeans, cotton, wheat, potatoes, other vegetables, citrus fruits, apples, and other deciduous fruits, showing the numbers I accessed just for a set of years. In 1996, they were using about 576 million pounds of ingredients, and by the year 2002, they're down to 483 million pounds. So that's what, approximately a 25% decrease in total pesticide use.
Well,
Ms. Sass,
15 or 20%.
Well, I'm just a simple farmer, an old simple farmer, but 570. Yeah,
And what we hope is that the shift is actually moving away from the older chemistry and the more toxic pesticides and moving towards reduced risk pesticides.
Again, Mr. Chair and
Representative Magnus.
Dr. Sass, I ask you a specific question. How many pounds of pesticide are we using in the United States today versus 6, 7, 8 years ago? I asked you that specific question twice, third time now.
I thought I answered it. And
no, you didn't tell me. How many pounds did we use then, and how many are we using now?
My understanding is that the levels have, the actual poundage has not changed much. But I'm not sure that the recent few years of statistics have kept up with the actual practices because of the new use patterns imposed by the Food Quality Protection Act.
Representative Magnus.
So you're... Dr. Sass, Mr. Chairman, you're saying the numbers I got from USDA are incorrect, too, then?
No. No, I'm sure they're correct.
Okay. So they are...
You mean because they're predicting a percentage of reduction? How?
The numbers...
Representative Magnus.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sass, I gave you the numbers 1996, 576 million pounds of pesticides used on the major crops in the United States. 2002, 483 million pounds. I don't have numbers past that. I'm sure they're accessible to some folks, and it's my understanding that's declining also. Do you agree with that, Dr. Sass?
Dr. Sass?
You said the USDA numbers you thought were correct.
I agree with the USDA numbers. Those are the numbers that I also look at.
Mr. Chairman, does your organization, the National Resources Defense Council, do you support biotechnology and agriculture?
Dr. Sass?
We don't work on that issue.
Representative Magnus?
Well, it's my understanding, Dr. Sass, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sass, that agriculture biotechnology is one of the tools that producers are able to use to cut down on the use of pesticide. Do you agree with that?
Dr. Sass?
My organization doesn't have a position on that issue. As a scientist and someone who follows the literature, I think in some cases that's shown to be true acutely. I'm not sure that that's been shown in the long term. And the reason why is because when you have when you have those kinds of crops, you get pests that revert to being resistant quite rapidly. And I'm just not sure how that plays out on a large scale. I don't think that data has been fully collected yet and we fully understand the impacts yet. I'm not confident it will result in an overall reduced pesticide use. But again, I hope that as we move through these pesticides, we can get rid of the ones that are most toxic and move to more responsible uses, less releases, and more reduced risk pesticides. And I know that technology and some of the biggest companies and small startup companies as well are developing reduced risk pesticides. And EPA has a program to fast-track the registration of the reduced risk pesticides to try and get them into commerce quicker. And so I think that will be effective. And in fact, we've supported the atrazine manufacturer on getting some of those to market quicker, which they've been developing.
So, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sass, you're not opposing all pesticides then, just the most dangerous ones.
That's correct.
Professor Magnus?
Obviously, Mr. Chairman, members, obviously, Senator Dole back in 2003 didn't think so, because the comments he's got in the middle of the page that you, I guess you handed out, are saying... atrazine registration is imperiled by the efforts of the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, which is trying to undermine the normal FIFRA re-registration process to advance its broader anti-pesticide agenda. So I'm glad to hear that you aren't opposed to all pesticides, just bad ones. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to allow Representative Blaine would like to make a comment to a previous point, then we'll go to Representative Moe, then we're going to go to our next witness. Your comment, Representative Blaine?
Just a comment in relation to a statement made by my colleague, Representative Hamilton, earlier. Representative Hamilton, you had made the comment that we were being forced to ban atrazine, and I just wanted to make the point to us, the committee members here, that we are not being forced to do anything. And we will decide what measures we will take regarding atrazine or any other pesticide that's being used in agricultural or other practices here within the state. And I do not mean that in a corrective manner to you, Representative Hamilton. I believe I understand where you're coming from, but just for the committee members' benefits to clarify that point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think to sum up the Blaine comments, and thank you, Representative Blaine, we're the Ag Committee. We can do whatever we want. Okay. Representative Moe, then we're going to Dr. Hayes. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sass, I appreciate you making the trip out here. I represent a district in northern Minnesota that's predominantly water. And the competitive disadvantage that some are concerned about in this committee because of agricultural concerns, I'm concerned about in terms of fishing-related tourism. Could you speak to two points for me? The first is, are there any other states who are actually looking at atrazine bans that are further along or have discounted these bans here in the United States? And the second point is, I asked the same question of the Environmental Protection Agency scientist who was here. Is there any research that actually shows, frogs are one thing, I don't eat them, but I do catch and eat fish, and a lot of people that come to where I live do. And so we're concerned about the safety of doing that to make sure that we can attract people to come to our resorts and eat our fish. So do you know of any research that speaks to that point?
Dr. Sass?
You bring up an excellent question, and when scientists say that, that's what they say right before they say, I don't know. I don't think there's any research in that area in terms of fishing or impact on tourism. Of course we know it's in the water, and of course we know that in the water it affects various organisms in the water. There are some fish studies, and Dr. Hayes will talk with you about some of them. I'm familiar with some of them. But your question is really very pragmatic. And you ask a very real world-based question, and it's one that you'll need to answer to your constituents. They drink it, they swim in it, they shower with it, and it affects their fishing areas, their recreational areas. And I don't think that's been evaluated. Now, EPA does have to do a cost-benefit analysis when it registers a pesticide under FIFRA, but in the case of atrazine, it did one really at the last minute. I think it was 2 pages long. It's a very incomplete cost-benefit analysis, and having a full cost-benefit analysis I think would be a value to all of us. I always feel very strongly that no matter where you stand or where you sit on these issues, having all the information in front of us helps us to have, I think, the most productive conversation possible.
To that point, Representative Johnson, then we're going to follow up with Representative Moe, and then I really want to get to Dr. Hayes from UC Berkeley here. Representative Johnson.
Actually, Mr. Chair, this is an earlier point made by Dr. Sass, if I could
certainly.
Finish up the...
Oh, okay, let's go back to Representative Moe, then we'll go to Representative Johnson. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first question was also pertaining to other states, if there's any... legislation or anything that you know of in other states.
Dr. Sass?
I'm aware that both Wisconsin and Iowa have implemented, and as far as I understand, successfully implemented restricted uses of atrazine. And that would sort of speak to my point of using it more intelligently and more responsibly and trying to let less escape into the environment.
Representative Moe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sass, on that exact point, it also dovetails with something you said a little bit earlier about working with Syngenta and supporting them in their efforts to put some usage or some varieties of atrazine on a fast track for registration. Could you detail a little bit more about that, please?
It wasn't atrazine. It was it was another product, and it wasn't atrazine. And actually, I'm sorry, now that I think about it, it was S-metolachlor, and it wasn't Syngenta, I'm sorry. There was something else that I was talking about with Syngenta. This was a Bayer product. I'm sorry about that.
I was going to mention that.
I'm sorry. My mistake. It's the problem with doing all of them. But there are a lot of both big companies and small startup companies that are producing these lower-risk alternatives, and EPA, I think, has a reasonable process for reviewing and fast-tracking them. Representative and I hope
Johnson.
That this is helpful.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you.
Okay, one quick question. Do you feel who do you think should pay for it, the registrant or the taxpayers? Who do you think should pay for the registration? Very, very briefly, because I want to get in, we're into Dr. Hayes' time right now.
That's written in my comments, and in brief, we think that the registrant should pay for it. The registrant right now does pay for it, but we think that the testing should not be done by the registrant, although we do agree that the registrant should be involved in discussions to get the testing underway, because they obviously have expertise on their own chemicals, but that the testing should be done preferably in-house, where it would certainly be more cost-effective.
Dr. Sass,
by the government.
I want to thank you very much for being here today. Are you hanging around Minnesota? Are you going to be at the meetings tomorrow with the atrazine bills?
I won't be, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I really thank you for coming here. I really appreciate your testimony.
I thank you all for your time.
Now I'd like to introduce Dr. Tyrone Hayes, Professor of Integrative Biology, University of California, Berkeley. And Dr. Hayes, before getting your PowerPoint, I never realized until I was in San Francisco a couple years ago, and we went out to eat. We went to this restaurant. All of a sudden, these two buses stopped at this restaurant, and this band came out. And it was the Cal Bears. And I didn't realize that the Cal Bears were University of California, Berkeley. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's correct. I didn't know that. But see, I want to get the Minnesota connection here for you. who was the quarterback that played for the Cal Bears, that played for the Vikings? I'll give you a hint. He would throw up ducks all the time. The ball would
just... Here in Toronto, that'd be Joe Capp.
Joe Capp. Joe Capp. Very good. So we do have a relationship here. I just want you to know that.
That's the band.
We have a
1969. So the band came in this restaurant and played through their whole pep band thing, and it was just awesome. And they played Stanford the next day and hadn't beat them in 7 years and beat them.
Wow.
That was a couple years ago. Okay, that's just for the record of the Ag Committee for Minnesota. So, with that, Dr. Hayes, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and then we'll go to your PowerPoint.
Okay. My name is Tyrone Hayes. I'm a professor of integrative biology. I received my bachelor's degree from Harvard University, my doctorate from the University of California, Berkeley. I conducted a postdoc at the National Institute of Health and Child Health and Human Development, and then I returned to Berkeley, where I've been a professor on the campus ever since. The work that I'm going to talk to you about today and my involvement in atrazine has been primarily funded by Novartis, Syngenta, EcoRisk, followed by the National Science Foundation, as well as a number of private, not-for-profit, and some profit companies that have funded the work. And I would also like to state for the record that in the year 2005 and in the last year, I've received no funding, no fees, no honoraria for any of the speaking engagements that I've been involved in Minnesota. Any such fees or payments were donated to organizations such as the Audubon Society, the Minnesota environmental advocacy groups, and things like that. So I've received no financial support for any of my involvement here.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. It is the Ides of March. I'd like to point out I'm neither here to praise nor bury atrazine. I'm here as a private and a concerned citizen just to present you with the facts so that an informed decision can be made on these bills that are about to come up. And I just want to make that clear from the outset. The other thing that I really want to focus on is I want to focus on some misrepresentation. I've read all the documents and transcripts from Ms. Lindsay's report, and I want to focus throughout my talk on some misrepresentation of the facts and of the data, if that's okay.
So, Dr. Hayes, are you going to be working off the handout dated February 25th?
I don't know which handout it is, but I did send a written response to several of her comments. I believe that's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, members, yes. You should have that at your...
Yes,
sir.
It'll be with pictures this time. The other thing I want to point out is that my work on atrazine has primarily been to examine effects that are consistent with the induction of the enzyme aromatase. I want to point out from the outset, though, that there are other mechanisms by which atrazine can cause damage to vertebrates, and much of that evidence has been published. I won't be presenting that work because my particular work focuses on this one mechanism, this one aspect of atrazine's effects. So normally, I'm sure as most of you know, if you are a male, you should make and secrete the hormone testosterone. Testosterone is the male hormone responsible for sperm, for your fertility if you're a male, and also for example, the deeper voices if you're a male, other masculine effects. But what we, and I'll show you, others have shown, is that atrazine induces in a variety of cell types the enzyme or the machinery to convert testosterone into the so-called female hormone, estrogen. And what we've shown in frogs, and I'll show you now evidence across vertebrates, is that the result of this in a male is a demasculinization or chemical castration, the loss of testosterone, and the subsequent feminization due to the production of estrogen inappropriately. Now, in our own work, we showed, and work published, and I'll tell you what's published and what's not, and what's new and what's mine and what's not, so that we can be clear. In work that we both conducted with Novartis, Syngenta, and EcoRisk, as well as work that we later published in the proceedings in the National Academy of Sciences, we showed that atrazine at low levels, at 0.1 parts per billion, induced abnormalities such as what you see here. This is the kidney of a dissected African clawed frog. These are the gonads of what should be a male, but this is an animal that displays two testes, followed by two ovaries, followed by large testes, followed by more ovary. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you what are called transverse serial cross-sections. So imagine that I'm slicing a salami and folding out the pieces. The color is going to be different because of the dye or stain that we use, that we use under the microscope. I'm going to show you these four sections. And it's really just further evidence, microscopic evidence, that indeed this is a testis. You can see the mixed blue and purple solid structure. These are two ovaries with the typical hole in the center or ovarian vesicle, followed by or surrounded by this connective tissue, this blue ring. Here's a large testis. The little holes you see in it are the testicular tubules, which are identical to the types of tubules that we as humans develop in our testis, where the sperm would or should develop. This is the ovary, and then following that are the two animals' two posterior ovaries. And this is not normal. And the reason that I put this up is I want to clarify there's been some suggestion that hermaphroditic development is a normal feature in amphibian development. That is not true. That is not true based on tens of thousands of observations in my laboratory. And although something like this may occur in fish and some invertebrates, it is not true for amphibians. It is inducible only by a hormone imbalance such as that we believe is induced by atrazine. I want to now start already to address some of the comments by Ms. Lindsay. For example, she said in her written statement that I received, as part of its effort to understand the available data, EPA scientists visited Dr. Hayes' lab and reviewed some of his raw data. So in one statement on page 7, she's saying that she did evaluate the raw data for the tens of thousands of animals that I just talked to you about. She later said in that same document, page 10, EPA, however, has never seen either the results from any independent investigator published in peer-reviewed scientific journals or the raw data from Dr. Hayes' additional experiments. So here she's saying she never saw the additional raw data. This is from her own statement. In 2002, Tom Steger, who was the EPA scientist who visited my laboratory, wrote to me by email, and this is a publicly available document from EPA. Tyrone, he wrote, although you are not required to provide EPA with any information, you have been very cooperative and have shared both the raw data and standard operating procedures from your research. Additionally, you have spent a considerable amount of time helping the Office of Pesticide Programs, that's Ms. Lindsay is the deputy director of, to understand the significance of your data, and you have provided insightful reviews of similar research efforts. So these are the other studies that I mentioned that EPA clearly knew about. But what I want to do is go back to Ms. Lindsay's statement, because remember, here she's saying, and I just want to show how she's been inconsistent and misrepresented really the facts. So on the top, she says here that she's never seen the additional raw data on page 10. On page 9, just before that, she actually writes, the actual meeting in June 2003, she's talking about the SAP, lasted 3 days and included about 3 hours of presentations by EPA over 4 hours of presentation by Dr. Hayes, and in parentheses, which included submission of additional raw data to the panel members. So she's clearly misrepresented the facts. On one page, she says she never saw the additional raw data. On another page, she says, I was allowed to submit those additional raw data. Syngenta's response to those data that were published was the following. And again, I want to show you how this work has been misrepresented to generate the confusion about what's really happening with atrazine. James Carr, the Syngenta-funded scientist, wrote in a press release, we have been unable to reproduce the low concentration effects in the larynx and gonads of the Xenopus levis, that's the species, tadpole that have been reported elsewhere in the scientific literature. Now, when that paper came out, when it was actually published, here's the hermaphrodite I just showed you. Here's a hermaphrodite from his own paper with two testes, more ovaries, a large testes, and more ovaries. So he generated for Syngenta the same abnormalities that we generated, even though he said he didn't. And this also speaks to whether or not you can trust data from the industry. If you look at the actual frequencies, these red arrows show the frequencies from his paper. And this is from an upcoming paper I have, actually in part already published. You can see that he not only generated the same hermaphrodites, at some doses they were at greater frequencies. There were more hermaphrodites than we produced. And one of the other arguments that Ms. Lindsay reported is that we use different terminology. So he referred to these testes as lobe testes. We call them discontinuous testes. But you don't need to go back and repeat the whole experiment to work out the terminology. Just ask me. The photographs of the type were all published in the paper. All the data are already there. We still got this problem that James Carr says he couldn't repeat our work. When I just showed you from his paper, the same morphologies, same abnormalities, produced at the same frequencies. If you look at his statistics, these are his data now still up here, he got p-values of 0.0003. Now that means that there's a 99.97% chance that the effect was due to atrazine. The probability of a random error is only 0.03%. So he got very strong statistics, same morphology, same proportion of animals. What they did was, he said he had a statistician say if you throw out the top dose, the p-value changed, and that's why he reported that he didn't produce the same effects that we did. But I can clearly show you here from his own data that, in fact, they produced the same types of morphologies, the same types of problems that we produce. I won't go through all of them, but there were several studies that Ms. Lindsay talked to you about that she said were scientifically flawed. Those flaws that she discussed, as I'll show you, did not apply to my work. And you can read this in the white paper from the EPA. You don't have to take my word for it. This 95-page white paper, you can see this. In one of these studies, just to give you an example of the kinds of things that Syngenta produced, in one of these studies, John Giese, lead author, concluded that chronic exposure to 16 to 28 micrograms of atrazine per liter did not affect mortality, growth, sex ratios, or gonadal anomalies in developing rhinoclamatins, another frog. And so I'm reading directly from his paper. Directly from his data, if you look at the percent mortality, everything died. Up to 87% of the animals died. This is from his paper. So this is the kind of work that Syngenta's generated to confuse the news. Of course you can't find hermaphrodites if everything dies. You certainly can't even talk about mortality. If 80% of your controls die, how can you even calculate LD50? But this is the quality of every single study that was submitted by Syngenta. Okay? The EPA's response, as you saw from Ms. Lindsay, was they never saw it and that all the data were flawed. And what I want to put up real quick, and I don't want you to read it, it's small print. What I just want to show you, and I want to get into another one of these issues. This issue is not a Tyrone versus the EPA or Tyrone versus Syngenta issue. I wasn't the first to publish the laboratory findings of hermaphrodites, of deformed gonads, in the laboratory or in the wild. Now, what I have up for you here are a list of studies, all that have now been published, all that the EPA evaluated. The ones in red are all the studies that said no, atrazine had no effect. I conducted analysis, this is now published in Biosciences, a peer-reviewed journal. I conducted an analysis and asked, what does it take to get a no study? What is the real problem? Why are we sometimes getting no effect? If you look at the species, it's not species. In other words, the scientists that get a no as the answer, they aren't just looking at a species that doesn't respond or is resistant. You get yes and no's with the same species. Turns out that the key value, the key characteristics, is also not study type. You get positive findings in the field, in the wild, and positive findings in the lab. And now each one of these types of studies has limitations. I'm in no way saying that my work was perfect. Okay? What I am saying, though, is the key factors, and we've shown this statistically now, is who funds the study. 100% of the negative studies were produced by Syngenta.
People, let's listen to the person that's given the testimony. We don't need the little heckles here.
100% were produced by Syngenta. The studies that showed effects on the gonads have been produced by my laboratory. They were first produced by a laboratory in Canada and published in Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. The studies in the wild were produced by a laboratory in Illinois before my stuff. Another study has been produced in Japan and even shows the molecular effects that I'll show you later. And then there's my work, which was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, National Institute of Environmental Health, and Nature, three of the top journals in the field, if not the top journals, all peer-reviewed. So it's not an issue of Tyrone versus everybody else. I'm one of four labs, and I now know of two other laboratories that I've met that are repeating the work and getting the same findings, as well as some collaboration we're doing with the U.S. Geological Survey. The other point I want to make while I have this up is these problems with loading and high mortality and death, they were not produced in the Canadian study, or my study, or the study in Japan, or in Illinois. Ms. Lindsay is misrepresenting the facts. Those loading and high mortalities, my mortality is 5-10%. Those high mortalities were all in the Syngenta-funded studies where minimally 50% of the test animals died. The other thing I want to point out is that all of those studies were done by the same author. So all of the negative studies weren't done by multiple nine different scientists. They're all the same scientists funded by Syngenta. And again, 100% of those studies have what I call an inappropriate design. They suffer from high mortality and contaminated controls. That was not the case in any positive study. Again, I want to go back to Ms. Lindsay's statement that EPA has never seen either results from any independent investigator published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. All of that work, you can go look it up. All of those studies that I just showed you were reviewed in the EPA's white paper. So they have indeed seen those studies. And this is just more of the same. The other thing that the EPA said that was incorrect, and again, it's not going to be my word versus hers, we're going to stick in Ms. Lindsay's document. She wrote that none of the studies on atrazine were conducted in accordance with standard protocols. There are no standard protocols. Okay? So she's claiming that they were rejected because we didn't follow standard protocol. And then 3 pages later, she writes, because there are no standardized test methods for any of these studies, describing why she has to work with Syngenta. So even within the same document, it's almost like two different people wrote the document. So again, my study couldn't have been thrown out because it didn't follow standard protocol. Because even as Ms. Lindsay admits herself, there is no standardized protocol. The other question I want to address is, and I think, I'm sorry I can't see your name, but I think you said it best when you asked about the fish. Why should you care about the frog issue? Are amphibians, and I saw this in one of the questions, I read through the transcript from February 16th, are amphibians canaries in the coal mine? And are these effects, do we see effects in other wildlife in humans? I want to point out that Glenn Fox wrote in Ecoepidemiology, so this sort of CSI on wildlife, if you will, the occurrence of an association in more than one species and species population is very strong evidence for causation. So I agree, I think, with everybody in the room. If I go out into the field and I find some hermaphroditic frogs and I find some atrazine, maybe something else in the wild did it. But we've got laboratory studies to back that up, and we've got now, according to Ms. Lindsay, we've got now flawed studies in not just four species, four families produced by four laboratories in three different countries showing gonadal abnormalities induced by atrazine in the laboratory. Furthermore, what I'm going to argue for you today is that, and you'll see the reason that I chose to look at the aromatase induction mechanism, I'm going to argue that it's not just frogs. I'm going to argue that we found these effects in frogs, but they have been identified in fish, and I'm going to address, I think, your question. We're going to look at the dates on when some of these studies were done. I'm going to show you that there were effects in reptiles and birds and in mammals consistent with our findings in amphibians, published by multiple laboratories across seven different countries and published. The primary mechanism for the effect that I study, and again, there are other mechanisms that we won't have time to talk about today, is that testosterone, when you're exposed to atrazine, gets converted to estrogen. That reduces your testosterone levels. You're demasculinized or chemically castrated. And I'm going to show you that occurs across vertebrates. Now, Ms. Lindsay wrote on page 10, it's been, I'm sorry, I don't know if it's Dr. Lindsay or Ms. Lindsay. I'll call it Dr. Lindsay to be safe. Wrote that it has been claimed, and I assume she's talking about me, it has been claimed that research on frogs shows that atrazine causes changes in the production of aromatase, an enzyme that is involved in the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. First correction. Aromatase is not involved in the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. Aromatase is the only way that you can make estrogen. I don't care if you're a fish or a farmer. There is only one way to make estrogen, and that is by converting testosterone to estrogen. If you have estrogen, you are expressing active aromatase. Okay? She went on to say, it has also been claimed that other scientists have shown similar effects in other species. And then she goes on to say that there is no direct scientific information to assess this hypothesis. Now, my first problem is her whole document goes on and on and on about the importance of the scientific advisory panel in developing EPA's policy statements or, you know, their opinions. There has been no scientific advisory panel on the induction of aromatase. So she's making this, I guess it's a personal opinion in this case. What I'm going to do now is the following. If you have testosterone, I don't care if you're a fish or a farmer, testosterone is responsible for sperm production and for laryngeal growth. It's the reason why the men in the room have the deeper voices than the sperm. If atrazine reduces testosterone, then consistent with this, you should see a reduction in sperm production and laryngeal growth, or growth of the voice box. I'm going to show you that this exists from published literature. This is not Tyrone versus EPA and Syngenta. This is not even frogs versus EPA and Syngenta. The first, fish and salmon, 1998, published study, Moore and Waring, peer-reviewed. If you look at testosterone levels in control males compared to atrazine, testosterone levels go down. We're not talking about frogs. We're talking about salmon. This is a published laboratory study. And if you look at the milk or the semen or sperm production in those animals, you see a reduction in the milk.
just like I told you, testosterone goes down, sperm production goes down. That's fish. That's fish, not frogs. And this has a p-value of 0.05. That means there's a 95% chance that this is the correct answer. Only a 5% chance of error. If you look at my data in amphibians, testosterone levels, you can see the atrazine. Testosterone levels go down so that they're not different from a female in frogs. You've gone from fish to frogs. If you look at the growth of the larynx, a growth of the voice box, starting at one part per billion, these animals have a voice box that looks like a female's. We've gone from frogs to fish. Our p-value is 0.01. There's only a 1% chance that this is an error. 99% sure that atrazine caused the effect. Now let's step up and go to mammals. Somebody asked in the question and answer with Ms. Lindsay, what about mammals? This is rats, a study by Nival. It's a European scientist. It's not me. It's not frogs. This is in rats. Testosterone levels go down, and if you look at control males compared to atrazine, their sperm number goes down. You see what we're building here? You're going to have to be convinced that salmon, African clawed frogs, and rats, all showing a decrease in testosterone and sperm, you're going to have to be convinced that that's all random in work from Croatia and Poland, where the rat stuff was done, Canada and Japan, where the frog stuff was done, salmon stuff was done in the U.S. You're going to have to be convinced that all that published literature is not really due to atrazine, despite these very significant p-values. 99.9% chance that atrazine caused this effect in the rats. What about humans? Published in Environmental Health Perspectives, 2003. We're nowhere near our five-year half-life yet. Let's look at atrazine levels. Shauna Swan's work shows that if you look at subfertile males in Missouri, these are males, men, who live in agricultural areas, who have trouble getting their wives pregnant. Their sperm count is half normal. If you look at their atrazine levels, with a p-value of 0.009, that's a 99.1% chance that atrazine is correlated with this low sperm count. Now, if this is all we had, then I'd say, yeah, many things could have caused that. But we got fish with low sperm count and atrazine exposure. We got frogs. We got rats. Now we have men in Missouri, and I want to point out this 0.18 part per billion. These men are urinating enough atrazine to produce those hermaphroditic frogs that I showed you in the beginning of this talk. Now let me break down like this. Let me back up so you see what I'm doing. I'm going to reduce the y-axis. I'm sorry, I'm going to increase the y-axis. So see, it's at 0.18 now. Okay? It's now up to 240, so the data is still here. You see what I did? I want to make sure it's no smoke and mirrors. And I did that because now I want to show you Lucas et al., 1993, published study. These are atrazine levels in the urine of field workers. I'm going to address something that came up in just a minute. Now I'm going to move the scale again. Actually, before I do that, let me point out, these field workers are now urinating 2,400 times the atrazine it takes to chemically castrate a fish or a frog. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you levels in applicators, 2,400. So they're urinating. So think about what that means. I can take the urine from an applicator, a bucket of it, and dilute it 24,000 times and produce hermaphroditic frogs. Now, pardon the expression, somebody asked, won't our farmers have to worry about the yield if we get rid of atrazine? I think you have to worry about the yield if you keep atrazine. Because remember, these numbers way down here, these are the numbers we showed were associated with the low sperm count. These numbers here are 1,200 times higher if you're an applicator. And here's the other thing. This work over here with the 0.2 parts per billion, that's from the drinking water. These levels, if you're a field worker, 95% of it's dermal across the skin. So if you live in the Twin Cities, you want to know who we're really protecting? If you live in the Twin Cities, and they're not giving me any money, this is free advertising, you can buy a Brita filter and take the atrazine out of your water. But if you're working on a farm, it's coming across your skin. If you're applying it on a farm, you're getting 24,000 times what it takes to chemically castrate a frog or a fish. So we've gone from fish to farmers. And I've shown you the first half of the problem, and I will admit that there are other mechanisms to reduce testosterone. One of them is the induction of aromatase. So now what's the other half of the equation? If you make estrogen, there are several consequences. Vitellogenin, vitellogenesis, that's the production of egg yolk protein. If you're a reptile or amphibian or a fish, oogenesis, that's the production of eggs. And mammary tumors are also estrogen dependent. So what I'm going to show you now is the second half. We're going to walk from fish to farmers, and we're going to look at the other half of the equation. What is the evidence that aromatase is turned on? In goldfish, there are also studies in largemouth bass. Testosterone levels in exposed goldfish. Remember before, we talked about salmon. Completely different researcher now in 2004 has shown that atrazine-treated males have low testosterone levels, and if you look at their estrogen, they have elevated estrogen levels. So these males, goldfish, have stopped making testosterone, just like the salmon did, and now they're making estrogen. P-value 0.05. In amphibians, this is data from Japan, not my data. The hermaphroditic males express aromatase. That red bar, the genes are turned on and are no different from the gene level that's expressed in a female frog. Not my data. We have similar data. Japan and I have shown the same thing independently. P-value of 0.05. In amphibians, further now looking at my data, we get what's called gonadodysgenesis, poorly developed gonads, and testicular oogenesis. I'll show you what that is. These males grow eggs in their testes. P-value of 0.001, published in Nature. This is data from Japan now again, showing that frogs make vitellogenin. These male frogs are making egg yolk protein. They're making egg yolk as if they're females. P-value 0.05, 95% chance that this is right. Here's what that looks like. Here's what it looks like, gentlemen. If you're a male and you make eggs and you try to yolk those eggs, you're looking at the testes of a frog from my laboratory, and all these big bulges, these are yolked up eggs popping out of the surface of this animal's testes. Okay? Imagine growing chicken eggs in your testicles. That's what you're looking at if you're a frog exposed to atrazine. And this just shows, one, the poor gonadal development, testicular development, so they can't grow sperm properly. And these slices show the slices through the large yolked up eggs bursting through the surface of this male's testes. Here's a male from the wild. Okay, looks like a normal testis. If I blow it up, these are testicular tubules, except instead of sperm, they're growing eggs. So it not only occurs in the lab, it occurs in the wild. If all I had was the wild data, I'd be like, yeah, you're right. Maybe something else caused it. But we can bring these animals into the lab, make them grow normally, or expose them to atrazine and make them grow like this. I want you to consider, when you think about this, one of the things that Sherry Ford of Syngenta said is that out of all of its field sites, Hayes has no trouble finding the species he studies. I want you, as you think about frogs, and I know you're thinking about fish already when you say this, just because the animals are there doesn't mean they're healthy and doesn't mean that the population won't eventually be affected. In fact, 82% of the sites we go to, we can't find frogs. Doesn't mean it's atrazine, but we know that atrazine's having an impact. And I brought this especially for you. This is an animal collected by the U.S. Geological Survey, not me, collected on the Mississippi River right here in Minnesota. It's a male on the left side with eggs in its testes and a full, you can't see it there because of how dark, a full ovary on the other side. It's literally half male, half female. In reptiles, so we've gone from fish to frogs, okay? In reptiles, aromatase is induced. These are atrazine-treated males compared to control males, and I can't share it with you, but I just reviewed a study that's coming out, published by another laboratory, showing that atrazine makes male turtles turn into female turtles. Turns on aromatase. I can't show you the data for birds, but I noticed a study in Japan coming out on chickens, and in female rodents, atrazine increased estrogen secretion from non-ovulated follicles. In fact, this work was done by Syngenta at the Syngenta laboratories. Atrazine increased the number of days in estrus, and atrazine increased blood levels of estrogen. Okay? The results in rodents, this is Stephen et al. From 1994. Here is mammary tumor incidence in control males, and here are the levels of mammary tumors in exposed rats. Significant increase, 0.01, study produced by Syngenta themselves. In humans, Sanderson et al., and now there are two other laboratories that have shown this. If you look at expression of aromatase gene or activity, here control males, here's atrazine, treated males, or treated cells. Okay? So we're talking about estrogen being turned on in fish. Fish are making egg yolk protein when they're males. Estrogen's being turned on in frogs, and they're making eggs. Estrogen's being turned on in rats, and they're developing mammary tumors. And now a human cell line and tissues, three other studies, three independent laboratories, shows that aromatase is induced by atrazine, p-value 0.05. And there's a study by Kettles from 1997 that showed that mammary cancer was associated with atrazine-contaminated well water with a p-value of 0.0001. Now, again, if all we had was the well water, the atrazine, and the breast cancer, I'd say, yeah, maybe there's other things that can do it. But you've got to be convinced that male fish making estrogen exposed to atrazine, that frogs making estrogen exposed to atrazine, turtles, reptiles, rats make estrogen and develop mammary cancer. You've got to be convinced that all of this is flawed random science to blow it off. I think the most telling thing in this all is not an experiment at all. Let me give you probably as much as I know about cancer. Pretend this is a normal breast cell, mammary cell. This ER stands for the estrogen receptor. I'm not going to argue that atrazine causes breast cancer. A carcinogen is something that causes a cell to become cancerous. That can be radiation, that could be UV light, that could be a chemical. Once that cell becomes cancerous, though, we know, it's been published for years, that those cells autonomously start to make aromatase and estrogen, and that estrogen binds the receptor and turns on that cell and causes it to grow into a tumor. That's an indisputable fact. Estrogen regulates breast cancer. It doesn't cause it, but it causes the cancerous cells to grow. The main treatment for breast cancer cells right now is tamoxifen. And while I'm on this, let me point out that cancer has replaced heart disease as the number one cause of death, and breast cancer, which is increasing the population, is the number one cancer in women, as prostate cancer is in men. Here's, I think, the most telling thing that you ought to consider. You know what the brand new treatment for breast cancer is right now? It just came out a year ago. It's a compound called exemestane. It's preventative. It blocks aromatase so that your estrogen is reduced, so that your cancer doesn't grow. 1 million people a day are exposed to a compound that in fish, frogs, turtles, alligators, rats, and human cell lines does the exact opposite of our brand new treatment for breast cancer. So, I would argue, you know, I would argue that we have more than just effects in more than one species. We've got effects in every vertebrate class that's been examined. Fish, frogs, reptiles, they didn't tell you about the bird study because it's not published, rodents, and associations in humans. Dr. Lindsay said, though, that there is no direct scientific information to assess this hypothesis. There's only three possible reasons why she could have made that statement. One is I fabricated it all, and I brought in this set. You can go to University of Minnesota Library and get these papers just like I can. They're online. So I didn't fabricate it. Two is, she's very uninformed. And three is, the only other reason I can think of, is she's directly misleading you. Now you have to decide between two and three what you think is the case. Either way, either she's misinformed or she's misleading. Either way, I don't think necessarily you want to follow the EPA's decisions and statements. What I want to do now, and I'm closing, is I don't want you to read this. It's all in red. All you should know is that it's bad. We have studies now from fish all the way up to farmers. I would argue that those are the costs. The benefits are that atrazine, and I know this is arguable. USDA estimates a 1.2% increase in corn yield. Syngenta told you 10%. That's not true. The 10%, according to their own website, is on no-till, a conservative till farm, which is less than a third of Minnesota farms. 4.3% used to be on their website. I think they've changed that now. And quite honestly, they're making a lot of money off of their number one selling product. What you've got to do, and again, I'm a citizen here, I think, my only goal is to bring you the information, especially when misinformation has been given. This is a comment, actually, just at the scientific advisory panel made by the Kansas Corn Growers Association, partially funded by Syngenta, commenting on why Europe has banned atrazine. And I guess the important comment is, down at the bottom, and they also, because of those changes, are not as competitive in the world market in the production of their commodities. That is a fact. And that's come up here. Europe's banned it. The home of Syngenta's banned it. Your neighbor, Wisconsin, has banned it on, I think, 11.2 million acres, somebody told me. And fewer than 60% of your farmers, or fewer than 40%, sorry, of your farmers are using it. 60% are getting by somehow. Wisconsin's getting by. Europe hasn't gone under. You have to decide. You have to decide for your constituents that all this work from fish to farmers is random flawed science that coincidentally all show the same thing. You have to decide that that risk is worth the benefits. You have to accept that Syngenta and the EPA has given Syngenta 3 years to do a study that should take 3 months. Take my lab, 3 months to do this phase one they're talking about. They don't have to turn it into 2006. John asked me if Syngenta tells me they've got 15 years to do all five phases. That molecular work can be done in a week in a good molecular lab. You have to decide, and I wrote the numbers down. You have to decide if you really think all those data are random, flawed science across fish to farmers. You have to decide if it's worth the risk. You have to decide if it's worth waiting 15 years when in that time we will apply 1.2 billion pounds of atrazine. In that time, 7.5 million pounds of atrazine will come down in the rainwater. In that time, 18 million pounds of atrazine will run into the Gulf of Mexico. In those 15 years, more than 15 million people will be exposed to atrazine. I want to end by a statement from the European Union and why they banned atrazine. I know it's a dirty phrase sometimes, but I'm going to read it anyway. Where threats of serious or irreversible damage to people and nature exist, lack of full scientific certainty about cause and effect shall not be viewed as sufficient reason to postpone cost-effective measures to prevent the degradation of the environment or protect the public health of its citizens. And lastly, Tim Pasteur of Syngenta has criticized me for taking his information to people who don't have enough independent information to make a truly independent decision. I apologize if I've done that, and I encourage you to seek other information from as many sources as are available to you, and I will put myself at your disposal to make any other information available that you need. And I thank you for the opportunity, in my view, to set the record straight.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hayes, and we are shutting down at 4:15. Dr. Hayes, are you here tomorrow?
I cannot be here tomorrow, actually.
Okay. Can you stay a little bit? When are you? You have a flight out tonight? Or?
I'm out tonight. I'm actually, National Geographic is premiering a film on our work on atrazine. I have to be there for that because they've supported me through my work. But I will be here as long as you want me here this evening.
Okay, because we'll shut it down 4:15, and because that's what we do in the Ag Committee, we shut down on time too.
Oh, I thought it was fine.
We'll have a couple of questions for a couple minutes, and if you could stay afterwards and maybe just visit with some folks who might ask some questions.
Stay as long as you would need me.
Thank you, Dr. Hayes. Representative Blaine. Representative Blaine. Could Dr. Hayes, could we get a copy of that PowerPoint so the members can have that?
Can
we get that online, or?
You know what?
I'll
burn a CD and I'll get it to you. All the data I've shown you are published or being published soon, so you're certainly welcome to.
Thank you, sir.
And I can give you all the references as well. I think they're in the document I gave you before.
Thank you, Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hayes, thank you for your presentation. So I'm following this correctly. Aromatase is the enzyme that is inducing sexist change, so shall we say. I'm just wondering if there are other chemicals out there or products out there that you would recognize as having the ability to have the same effect?
Yes. We have examined more than 20 chemicals used on corn in Nebraska. Atrazine is the only one that works through this mechanism. Other triazines, like cymazine, for example, have been shown to do the same thing by other laboratories, not my laboratory. In fact, Syngenta's own laboratories have shown this. I know some chemicals that reverse aromatase, but I don't know of other chemicals other than triazines that turn aromatase on. Now, a chemical that would bind the estrogen receptor could produce some of these abnormalities, but atrazine does not bind the estrogen receptor. Some of the chemicals, for example, DDT or DES, will bind the estrogen receptor, but that's a different mechanism.
Representative Blaine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because basically what we're saying with aromatase is it's an endocrine disruptor. On the information that we received here in the past, that there are a great number of other endocrine disruptors that are very common in our environment here, and I'm just wondering if any of those types of products were taken into consideration with your research.
Yes, we've looked at a number of different chemicals, and as I said, of those used on corn, we have not identified other endocrine disruptors. What I can tell you, the significance of atrazine is that I know of no other chemicals that are effective at such low doses, and I also know of no other chemicals that are so persistent in the environment. I think you heard earlier, 60 to 80 million pounds being used per year, and there's a study in France, for example, where atrazine's been banned for 14 years. It is still in the aquifers and groundwater. So I know of no other chemical with the water solubility, with the extremely long-lived, long persistence, and active at such low levels. So while there may be other chemicals out there, none that we've identified, while there may be other chemicals of concern, none are as important in the environment, I think, as atrazine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hazen, I don't have the document with me, and so I'm going off of memory here. But Dr. Hayes, one of the other, and I'm not strictly talking about herbicides or pesticides in crop production or agricultural production that would be considered endocrine disruptors, but one that was listed was coffee. And if we look at how much coffee is dumped down the sink every day, or is drank every day and passed through our bodies as urine, would it be not fair to say that that coffee could play a vital role as an endocrine disruptor as well as atrazine?
Dr. Hayes?
Caffeine interferes with what's called a second messenger system, and that's why, for example, you have to urinate or go to the bathroom after coffee.
Mm-hmm.
The differences are it's a natural product that we are voluntarily taking into our bodies. It's not one that's persistent in water systems the way that atrazine is as a synthetic. Caffeine is a natural product of plants. And so the differences are that, one, our biggest exposure to coffee is choice. Right. You drink it, you have a choice to drink it or not drink it. If you're an agricultural worker or somebody living in an agricultural area, you don't have a choice of being exposed or having atrazine in your drinking water.
I'm pro-choice on coffee, just so you know. On coffee.
As long as you have a choice.
I'm going to go to Representative, we need to wrap this up. Representative Blaine and then Welty, and then we're going to shut her down. Representative Blaine?
One final point, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Hayes. Your opinion. If we put these same animals that you ran these tests in your study and in your very lengthy study under the same or relative levels of let's say coffee, do you feel that we would see the same results?
No, coffee doesn't work through this mechanism. Okay. Coffee again. Oh, sorry. Yes, caffeine again doesn't work
through this mechanism. It's a diuretic. So it caused you to urinate. I would argue that the adverse effect of excess or urgent urination is much different. It's not a bigger risk as mammary cancer or prostate cancer, the number one cause of death in men and women. It's not a bigger risk as an irreversible, and that's the other important issue, as an irreversible induction of hermaphroditism.
But isn't not considered coffee considered as an endocrine disruptor?
Endocrine disruptor is a broad term for anything that interferes with an hormone's action. Caffeine does not interact with this system that I've shown you. Nothing to do with testosterone or estrogen. Okay, and coffee is a reversible effect. If I drink coffee, my heart rate goes up, and I go to the bathroom and pee. By the end of the afternoon, a couple hours, I'm back to normal. If I get prostate cancer, breast cancer, by the end of the day, I'm not normal. If I'm exposed as a fetus, if I'm exposed as an amphibian that's supposed to be male, that grows testes in its, grows eggs in its testes, I will not grow up and be normal. I won't grow out of it. I will be, if you're exposed as a fetus, these frogs are chemically castrated for life. And studies out of the National Institutes of Health shows even if the mothers in rats are fed atrazine, their pups come out with a higher incidence of reproductive cancers. That's a lot different from having to urinate very quickly.
Representative Welty, and then we're going to, I'm sure it's 4:15 somewhere in the world. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and actually, I know Representative Hamilton has a question too, and I think he raised his hand before me. But I'll keep this real quick. I just want a clarification, Dr. Hayes, on the study that you did and who helped fund your study.
Dr. Hayes?
Initially, I was funded by Novartis, Syngenta, EcoRisk. In fact, I think there's somebody standing back there that was involved in the initial studies. So initially, I was funded by Novartis through EcoRisk and then Syngenta through EcoRisk. After leaving that contract, I was funded by the National Science Foundation. My students were funded by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And then in a second study, I was later funded by the World Wildlife Fund, a couple other nonprofit organizations that I have to get, Alton Jones Foundation, and one other that skips my mind. And then subsequent to that, I've been funded by Park Water Foundation, which is a private water company.
Wealthy. Thank you. And just a quick follow-up to that. Did you include your name on the list of all those studies that were done and who funded them? I just want a clarification on that. Did you also include your name and your study as being funded by Syngenta?
That study partially... The only study that was funded that I did by Syngenta was listed here as partially 2000.
Okay.
When they reported it to the EPA, they did not put my name on it.
Representative Wealthy.
Thank you.
Okay,
which is fine with me.
Okay. I apologize to the members that we didn't get to there. I've got a list here, but we are going to shut it down just for the equal time type things. I'm trying to really be sensitive on that. And
Can I make one other sensitive?
Dr. Hayes?
I just want to say if people did want to contact me by email, it's tyrone@socrates.berkeley.edu or Tyrone, or you can do it probably through Jeanette Primer if you need to get a hold of me by email. I'll be glad to answer any questions, and I'll be here for a little while today.
I thank you so much, and Rip Hamilton and Erdahl and others, if you could talk to Dr. Hayes afterwards, that would be a great thing. I want to thank Mr. Curry for putting this together. You had quite some distinguished witnesses here, and we thank Mr. Yaman, Dr. Sass, and Dr. Hayes. Thank you very much. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.